and Shaw should be familiar to all of you who read the Arsk Journal. Since 1995, Joe has been the principal author of the copyright column that has appeared as a regular journal feature since 1993. To date, Brian Shaw and Joe Reedy have answered copyright questions from Arsk members and other readers in 11 consecutive issues of the journal. I think that Cumston and Shaw has provided a remarkable contribution to Arsk, for which we are extremely grateful. We don't have too many opportunities to thank them in person, so I'm especially delighted to be able to bring him here to you today to talk about copyright law in the digital era. Cumston and Shaw is the second largest independent law firm in upstate New York that deals exclusively with intellectual property law. A member of the firm since 1995, Joseph Reedy holds a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry from the University of Rochester and a law degree from Dayton School of Law. Before attending law school, Joe was a research scientist with Bristol-Myers Squibb. His practice at Cumston & Shaw specializes in copyright, patents, and trademarks in the chemical and polymer fields and in the mechanical arts. May I introduce Joseph Reedy.
Thank you for inviting me here today. I appreciate the honor. And this is my first time attending one of these conferences, and if I knew it was so exhibit formatted, I would have brought some toys of my own to show you and different musical compositions. But I'm just going to explain some digital copyright law to you and probably answer some questions at the end of it. Just a little bit of background. I'm sure you're all familiar with this. U.S. copyright law has evolved over the past century or so. Most of us are in your field with the archives and recordings back in the 30s and 40s are concerned with the Copyright Act of 1909. It was a very stringent act. It required that notice be put on all published materials in order to gain any copyright. If you didn't have notice on there, you would lose your copyright. Further, it had a different time period for copyright, which included extension terms, and so forth. You had to pay certain fees on certain times. The U.S., as alluded to earlier in the previous speaker, did not sign the Berne Convention back in 1889, but the U.S. finally came in line in 1976 to amend the Copyright Act, which would conform more closely to the Berne Convention and the worldwide standards where copyright notice was not required to be published on each and every article, and therefore you wouldn't lose any of your copyright rights. Further, it standardized the time period for the copyright duration of life of the author plus 50 years. But over the last few years, copyright law has evolved to include different mediums of communications. And the world under the World Intellectual Property Organization has signed some agreements to modify the existing copyright laws, and the U.S. has implemented those agreements, or is in the process, I should say, of implementing those agreements. One of the main topics I want to talk about today is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998, which is being sponsored by Orrin Hatch in the U.S. Senate. A similar bill went through the House. I'll touch on some of the main points and also the differences that are going to come about in the next few years regarding library exemptions and archival recordings, things of that nature. A little bit of history. The WIPO Copyright Treaty covers computer programs, movies, and other audiovisual works, sound recordings, and so forth. The Hatch bill implements the WIPO provisions. It requires the foreign countries, and this is from a U.S. point of view too, so if I'm offending any Europeans, I'm sorry, but it requires many of the foreign countries to raise their level of protection to U.S. standards. There's a few changes in the copyright bill that Orrin Hatch is proposing. A few of the significant changes I want to discuss today. And some of them may be on base or specifically touch your concerns. Other ones concerning online service providers may not be particularly relevant to you in the broad scope, but may give you some information in regards to if you do set something up on AOL or on Netscape and it goes out, Netscape and AOL, they're not going to be liable. It's more going to be, you're going to be liable for what you're doing if you're infringing any copyrights. So I'd like to start out first, some of the significant changes that the bill will provide for protection against circumvention of technological measures employed by copyright owners to control access to their works. This bill also provides parallel protection against circumvention of technological measures employed to prevent unauthorized reproduction, adaptation, distribution, performance, or display of a copyrighted work. And what that means is if there was a big debate in the House about this, Representative Boucher of Virginia has proposed a number of amendments that have failed to change the focus of this provision. The provision as it stands is more directed to the actual hardware that's being employed by people to circumvent other copyright owners' protections that they put on their works. Representative Boucher wanted to change it to more of the conduct. He wanted to make the person or the person the conduct of the person liable for infringing or circumventing the technological measures, not the actual machines. And the reason for that was, if you're familiar with the Betamax case of Sony back in 1976 regarding VCRs, back then they thought that VCRs were going to be, well, at least the Universal Studios thought that the VCRs were going to be the worst things ever and destroy the movie industry, and they wanted to ban all VCRs. Well, the court decided that the VCRs, even though they may have some capability of infringing copyrighted works, have a substantial non-infringing purpose. And this is, again, is what Orrin Hatch is proposing here, that most of the hardware that he wants to hit in this bill would be ones that wouldn't have a substantial non-infringing use. He wants to go after hardware that is directly designed to circumvent anybody's protection of their copyrighted works. And that includes encryption and descramblers and things of that nature. Further, the bill provides protection for the integrity of copyright management information, or CMI. And that's information conveyed in connection with a copyrighted work to identify the work, its author, and or copyright owner, and the terms and conditions for use. Some of the exemptions that people here would be interested in are for innocents or innocent infringers, and for libraries, archives, and educational institutions. The libraries, the archives, and educational institutions are permitted to circumvent these technological measures to gain access to a work for the limited purpose of determining whether to acquire such work, and subject to a copy must not be retained longer than necessary to make such good faith determination, and may not be used for any other purpose. So if you're in a library and you need to gain access to something that is protected through technological measures, and you're only looking at it for a good faith determination, you're actually allowed to do that, but only for a very limited and narrow scope. The exemption only applies with respect to a work when an identical copy of that work is not reasonably available in another form. So you have to do a little investigation as to whether or not this work that you're trying to get at could be obtained in a different form. Some of the rules here that if a library or archive or educational institution willfully breaks in or circumvents the technological measures for the purpose of commercial advantage or financial gain, the corporation, well, the library or archive will be subject to civil fines, but not criminal fines. That was Title One. Title Two deals with the Internet copyright infringement liability, and this is mainly directed at service providers. And what they're proposing here is that under certain conditions, the service provider will only be subject to injunctive remedies, not monetary remedies, if they meet certain safe harbors. And the safe harbors are if the service provider acts as a mere conduit for infringing transmission, which means that they are not initiating the transmission, they are not the ones starting this or sending it out. It's some subscriber is using their service, and they, in a way, are either blind to it or are hands off. Two, if the transmission was carried out technologically without selection of the material by the OSP, the OSP is online service provider. The OSP did not select the recipients of the possible infringing work. No copy of the material is made by the OSP or maintained on the network longer than necessary for its communication. And the material is transmitted without modification to its content by the OSP. The clause here would exempt the OSPs from monetary damages for system caching, which is temporary storage of the material as part of an automatic process. So once again, this clause in the bill is codifying a case that came down in 1995, Religious Technology Center versus Netcom Online Communication Services, and that dealt with, I believe, the Church of Scientology. And the District Court for Northern California in 1995 ruled that the provider was not liable for direct or vicarious infringement for acts committed by the bulletin board operator. In this case, what was going on, the bulletin board operator was publishing excerpts and also full text documents of the Church of Scientology, and the Church of Scientology not only went after the bulletin board's operator, but also Netcom. And the court ruled that Netcom, because they didn't have the control, and that's a very important feature here, the control that I just listed with the six conditions here. If they don't have the control over it, they can't be held liable. A further provision here states that the OSP must adopt a policy of terminating subscribers who are repeat offenders, and that they do not interfere with standard technical measures used to identify or protect the copyrighted works. And just a word of caution to people, if you are transmitting possibly infringing material over the internet, the service provider, if they ever become informed of your activity, can shut you down. And just make sure you're aware of that I don't think they do it out of the blue, but they'll probably send you a warning notice first. But they are allowed to do that basically to save their own skin. And the service provider will not be liable to you for if they remove or disable your access due to your infringing activity. Another quick topic I'd like to talk about is the computer maintenance or repair section of Title III here. The bill states that it wouldn't be an infringement for an owner or lessee of a machine, i.e. computer, to make or authorize to make a copy of the computer program where such a copy is made simply by turning on the machine for purposes of maintenance or repair. This is the case where it's provided that the program on the machine is authorized and the copy is not used for any purpose other than maintenance or repair and is destroyed immediately after the maintenance or repair is completed. Once again, this is important in the sense that if you're a library or independent or individual and you need something repaired on your computer after it crashes, you're able to make this temporary copy, or it should be transitory copy, of this computer program immediately for service repair uses only. Now, something I want to talk about here would be the library exemptions. The exemptions for the libraries and archives under Section 108 under this new Digital Millennium Act of 1998. I just want to review a little bit with everybody Section 108 of the copyright law, which states that libraries and certain archives and educational institutions are exempt for infringement. And I, as a lawyer, I have to read from the statute book, so I don't want to get anything wrong. Stating that it's not an infringement of copyright for a library or archive or any of its employees acting within the scope of their employment to reproduce no more than one copy or phono record of a work or to distribute such copy or phono record under the conditions specified by this section if, one, the reproduction or distribution is made without any purpose of direct or indirect commercial advantage to the archive or library. The collections of the library or archives are, one, open to the public, or two, available not only to researchers affiliated with the library or archives or with the institution of which it is a part, but also to other persons doing research in a specialized field. And three, the reproduction or distribution of the work includes a notice of copyright. One of the provisions of the new bill would allow the library or archive to make three copies of the digital format. And I want to get a little bit more about the digital formatting and what your liabilities are and what you have to do before you start making digital copies. So a little bit more on the on Section 108, the old rule, stated that Section B stated that the rights of reproduction and distribution apply to a copy or phono record of an unpublished work duplicated in facsimile form solely for purposes of preservation. They have changed the language in the bill here to state that it could be in any digital form, stating that striking the facsimile form and stating that any such copy or phono record that is reproduced in digital format is not otherwise distributed in that format and is not made available to the public outside the premises of the library or archives in that format. So once again, they're updating the language to get away from just the facsimile format, because in 1976 that was basically the only way people knew how to copy something at that time. Now they're going to include the digital formatting, but they're also putting on for more restrictions, saying that if it's not otherwise distributed in that format and is not made available to the public outside the premises of the library or archives in that format. That's an important distinction. The rules require that the library or archive must investigate to a reasonable degree whether or not you can obtain the copy in a different format, and that just includes almost common sense rules, asking around different people, checking the brief history of the publication of the document, just checking some copyright records, making sure that you have to do it to a reasonable degree. It's not a death rule, but you should investigate before you start making digital copies. A few more adaptations of Section 108, which I believe are important. The rights of reproduction under Section 108 apply to a copy or phono record of a published work duplicated in facsimile form solely for the purpose of replacement of a copy or phono record that is damaged, deteriorating, lost, or stolen if the library or archive has, after reasonable effort, determined that an unused replacement cannot be obtained at a fair price. They state that, and again, this is a little bit repetitious, but they state that the new rules would say, if the copy or phono record reproduced is currently in the collections of the library or archives, and any such copy or phono record that is reproduced in digital format is not otherwise distributed in that format and is not made available to the public outside the premises of the library or archives in that format. And the other rules, the standard rules that some of you are probably familiar with, stating that you cannot give away these copies to users of the library. When a user comes in to make his or her request or from that of another library or archive of no more than one article, it's going to go to three, or other contribution, I'm incorrect, of no more than one article or other contribution to a copyrighted collection or periodical issue, or to a copy of a phonorecord of a small part of any other copyrighted work, if the copy or phonorecord becomes the property of the user and the library or archives has had no notice that the copy or phonorecord will be used for any purpose other than private study, scholarship, or research. And once again, you cannot give it away for commercial gain. The library or archive displays prominently at the place where orders are accepted and includes on its order form a warning of copyright in accordance with the Register of Copyrights. I want to go a little bit into depth about ephemeral recordings and extending the copyright term. This two different issues here. The ephemeral recordings are proposed by Senator Hatch again in the same bill, stating that if you are on a computer screen and you need to make a copy of that computer screen, or I should say, for instance, if you are on the internet and a copy of that comes up on the computer screen, you are not liable for copyright infringement as long as you make it's only a temporary copy and you do not redistribute such copies. Some of the pertinent parts of the bill states that when you make the ephemeral recording, for instance, in circumventing the technological protection measure that controls access to a particular portion of the program, those elements of the program that are necessary to achieve interoperability of an independently created computer program with other programs and that have not been previously been readily available to the person engaging the circumvention to the extent that such acts of identification and analysis do not constitute infringement under this title. Again, when you are making these ephemeral recordings and copies, if it goes to the interoperability of the system and you only use it for a temporary time period, you will not be it will not constitute infringement. Talk a little bit about the House bill, which was passed in March and is now pending in the U.S. Senate, which would extend the copyright terms. The bill pertains to the extension of copyright protection for the life of the author plus 70 years. Currently, it's 50 years after the death of the author. This would adjust the terms for anonymous and synonymous works, works for hires, and unpublished works, and would add 20 years to renewal terms. Once again, we'll talk about the infringement exemptions for libraries and archives under Section 108. And please keep in mind that even if 108 does not apply, Section 107, which is fair use, which we'll discuss in a few moments, may also come into play for people who need an exemption. The infringement exemptions are going to be amended to provide that during the last 20 years of a copyright, libraries and archives, as well as nonprofit educational institutions, could, quote, reproduce, distribute, display, or perform in facsimile or digital form copies of works for purposes of preservation, scholarship, or research. However, they must first make a reasonable investigation to determine that none of the following conditions are present: that the work is subject to normal commercial exploitation, a copy or phonorecord of the work can be obtained at a reasonable price, or the copyright owner or its agent provides notice pursuant to Copyright Office regulations that neither of the first two conditions apply. The bill also contains a provision amending Section 304C, which regards terminations of transfers, to create a new window at the end of the original copyright term in which authors or their heirs could bargain for the benefit of the extended term. Now, that hasn't been fully explained or disclosed at this time, so we're going to have to reserve some comment on that. The similar bill is pending in the Senate at the present time, although Orrin Hatch, I believe, is also planning to support that. Now, I didn't know if everybody was familiar with Section 108, the library and archive exemptions, in terms of copying and what the library must and must not do before they allow copying and promotion of materials through the interlibrary system. But as stated earlier, Section 108 of the Copyright Statute defines the scope of permissible reproduction of copyrighted works by the libraries. To qualify for the limited privilege of copying, the library must satisfy a number of thresholds. As stated previously, the copying must not be for purpose of directly or indirectly providing a commercial advantage to the library. The collection of the library also must be either open to the public or at least open to those who may be doing research in the specialized field of the collection. The permitted copying extends only to certain works. For user-requested copying, and this, I believe, is an important point that I'd like to talk about a little bit, the library's right to reproduce does not extend to musical, pictorial, graphic, or sculptural works. Copying of sound recordings is permitted. However, if the sound recording includes a musical work, then copying is not permitted. In contrast, library copying for preservation and deposit purposes is not restricted by the type of work. The number of copies that may be made is set forth in the present statute at one. Specifically, no more than one copy or phono record of copying and what the library must and must not do before they allow copying and promotion of materials through the interlibrary system. But as stated earlier, Section 108 of the Copyright Statute defines the scope of permissible reproduction of copyrighted works by the libraries. To qualify for the limited privilege of copying, the library must satisfy a number of thresholds. As stated previously, the copying must not be for purpose of directly or indirectly providing a commercial advantage to the library. The collection of the library also must be either open to the public or at least open to those who may be doing research in the specialized field of the collection. The permitted copying extends only to certain works. For user-requested copying, and this, I believe, is an important point that I'd like to talk about a little bit, the library's right to reproduce does not extend to musical, pictorial, graphic, or sculptural works. Copying of sound recordings is permitted. However, if the sound recording includes a musical work, then copying is not permitted. In contrast, library copying for preservation and deposit purposes is not restricted by the type of work. The number of copies that may be made is set forth in the present statute at one. Specifically, no more than one copy or phono record of work can be made. However, the statute permits isolated, unrelated reproduction and distribution on separate occasions. As I said, the current bill that's going through the Senate has raised that limit to three. Just a little touch on the user-requested copying. Once a library has met the previous conditions, the statute permits both user-requested copying and library-requested copying. For user-requested copying, the library must have the item in its collection or in the collection of an interlibrary loan library. The user-requested copying is governed by the restrictions on the type of work to be copied, In addition, the library must prominently display a copyright warning where the copying is requested. The library must not have any notice that the copy will be used for any purposes other than private study, scholarship, or research. Further, the copy must become the property of the user. Therefore, the library cannot loan the copy to the user. In user-requested copying, a distinction is made between the copying no more than one article of a periodical or small part of the copyrighted work and the copying of the entire work or a substantial portion of the work. If only a single article or small part of a larger work is requested, the library may copy the requested amount. If the copying of a substantial portion or the entire work is requested, then prior to copying, the library must make a reasonable investigation and attempt to obtain a copy at a fair price. Even if the work is out of print, if a used copy is in reasonably good condition is available through ordinary trade sources at a fair price, then the copying is not permitted. And one of the reasons I wanted to go over that again was that in this day and age now of digital copying, those rules still apply. You can't just say, oh, well, I don't know where anything else would be. Let's just make another digital copy. You still have to investigate those other alternative resources. For copying for the library purposes, the libraries are entitled under certain circumstances to reproduce individual items in their collection. Unlike the user-requested copying, the right of reproduction is not limited by the type of work to be copied. Instead, permissible copying for the library depends upon whether the work is unpublished or published. Therefore, the library may be permitted to reproduce sound recordings of musical works. For the unpublished works, that are currently in a library's collection, the library may duplicate the sound recording in facsimile fashion, and again, if the bill passes, it'll be digital fashion too, under certain circumstances. For the sole purpose of preservation and security of the collection, or for a deposit for research for another library that has an open collection. After the copy has been made for preservation of the collection, a second copy for preservation of the collection cannot be made until the first copy has been damaged, deteriorated, lost, or stolen. However, the library may make a single copy on separate occasions for deposit in other libraries that are not all members of the same group. Now, for published works, the library must first make a reasonable effort to obtain an unused replacement at a fair price. If no copies are available, then the library may make one entire sound recording of the work in facsimile fashion to replace the copy that is damaged, deteriorating, lost, or stolen. Once again, the new rule will update this to include digital copying. This rule published rule differs from the rule for unpublished works in that it does not include the right to make copies for deposit in another library. And at the present time, it's going to be the same. That's not going to change under the new act. In addition, the library must make a reasonable effort to obtain the sound recording through normal trade sources. And finally, the reproduction of published works requires that the sound recording be being replaced as damaged, deteriorating, lost, or stolen. In contrast, the statute for the unpublished works implies that the library may retain the original and the copy, while interlibrary associations are subject to provisions of Section 108. The interlibrary arrangements are specifically permitted so long as the arrangement does not have the primary purpose or effect to substitute for the subscription or purchase of the work or sound recording. At the present time, these bills are going through Congress at a fairly rapid rate. A number of these new digital access bills for copyrights have gone through at a rate of about 3 a month. Many amendments have been proposed by different legislators and have gone nowhere, but have been some of their amendments have been picked up and added to the final bill. That's evidenced by Senator Hatch's bill. At the present time, I believe that Senator Hatch's bill will pass through the Senate, and the amendment of the Copyright Act will include the specific language for digital formatting and digital access. I don't have any more material to present to you, and I'll open the floor for questions.
You were going to go back to 107.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Section 107 deals with fair use. And there's four factors in 107 that must be addressed. And fair use is going to apply to reproductions of, or in copies or phonorecords by any other means specified for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, including multiple copies for classroom use, scholarship or research. So this does not mean that only libraries or educational institutions. If you're a writer and you want to critique somebody's music or other printed material, you're allowed to use some of their material for that purposes. For that purpose, in determining whether the use is made of the work is a fair use, four factors must be taken into account: the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of a commercial nature or is for a nonprofit educational purpose, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole, and the effect of the use upon the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work. Just to touch on a few of these issues, for instance, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. Back in the 70s, a news magazine, and I believe it was, I think it was U.S. News and World Report or Newsweek, got a hold of President Ford's memoirs and decided they would publish it. And they took out substantial portions, substantial enough to hurt the quote-unquote effect or commercial success of this book. And the publishers sued, Harper Publishers sued, and the fair use defense was invoked, but was not successful. The fact that a work is unpublished shall not itself bar a finding of fair use if the finding is made upon consideration of all the above factors. It's not, you can't just pick and choose one or two of them. You have to have all four wrapped up and evaluate each one. So when you are using somebody else's work for news reporting or critiquing, make sure that you don't take the whole thing. Make sure you don't reproduce everything and then just add a paragraph of your own analysis, such as I didn't like it for such and such a reason, because that's not going to get you off the hook. You have to be selective, and you have to make sure that you really are using it for criticism, comment, news reporting, and that the four factors that I previously mentioned are all met. Okay, and
is it on? Thank you. There's a new development in fair use that I'd be interested to hear you address. We're beginning to get journals online. In fact, the saving in production costs is so great that they're predicting that the journals could go the way of the dinosaur, the print journals could go the way of the dinosaur. There is a journal already online called the Journal of the Society for 17th Century Music, and the first issue, if you could call it that, featured a soprano singing Baroque music and showing how different she has to sing, how different she has to interpret the French versus the Italian repertoire. Now, question is, could such a person do such a demonstration with 20th century music, with music whose author copyright is still in force? How would you imagine fair use coming in putting that kind of performance online?
Well, once again, it's I wouldn't take the whole performance and put it online, then add my commentary. If the sound recording and the underlying, well, the musical composition and the underlying sound recording are still protected by copyright,
She's singing precisely for the journal.
Oh, okay. I see. Well, has she given you her permission to use this?
I'm questioning her right to sing a copyrighted song.
Okay. For the journal.
Asking if she has.
Okay. Well, her performance rights would be, she would be infringing performance rights. But if you use it for fair use defense, or you invoke the fair use defense, you have to make sure all four factors are met. If they are, you'll be successful in fair use. If they're not, then she's clearly, if you put this on the internet or on the online, you could be in some trouble there. So if you use it according to the four factors outlined in fair use, that would be because what you're doing is you're commenting or critiquing the differences between the French and the Italian. If you use it under those guidelines and fall within the four factors, then you would have a good chance under fair use defense.
Okay, I'd like to ask you to identify yourself also before you ask your questions, please.
I'm Sarah Velez, and I'm with the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound of the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. I have a question because now with these days with our homepages, web, you know, World Wide Web access, being that we're a sound archives, I would, you know, we were thinking of perhaps putting up some sound bites on our webpage to illustrate some of our historical aspects of our collection. And I was wondering what the regulations are for that, and if there is a minimum, if we do it under a certain amount of seconds, a really small bite, do we still need copyright approval, or could you address that?
Yes. This may sound like a very general answer, but unfortunately, at this stage, we are still operating under the, well, I shouldn't say unfortunately, at this stage, we're still operating under existing copyright law. The amendments to the certain copyright laws regarding digital access and digital availability of sound bites on web pages is just being addressed. If I had a core precedence to tell you that you have to use, you can only use, say, 3 or 4 seconds of a sound bite or 15
I
seconds.
I heard 7 seconds.
Something like that. That's something that I heard that too, is being thrown around.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't give you a definite answer on that. I would believe that under the conditions that exist today, where you can use certain sound bites and you for certain periods of time for promotion, for criticism or critique, things of that nature, why they wouldn't be rolled over to digital formatting or digital uses would be, I don't understand why they wouldn't be, but I can't give you a definite answer as to, well, you're allowed to use 7 seconds and that's it, you can, if they give you a sound bite for publication on a phono record, can you do this on the web? At this point, it's still being decided.
So what would be your advice if we wanted to give some samples of recordings in our collection?
Well, I would first investigate, as always, the copyright status. Mm-hmm. And then I would ask if there is a valid copyright on it, I would request permission from the
holder of the copyright.
From the holder of the copyright. And I would also investigate what their history is. Do they allow people to do this in other mediums and also on the web pages now? And see if they are hostile to it, or are they amenable to it, and that they allow certain set. For instance, if you wanted or needed a 15-second sound bite, and they're only willing to give you 4 seconds, this is an individual case by case scenario. I would first investigate the copyright status and then contact the copyright owner.
But are they working on this now? I mean, as
I believe they are, because this is when we were talking about the 7-second time frame.
Right.
I've had some of the journals that have come through my office. I've read that standards are all over the place. There's a lot of amendments going through the House. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, if I start commenting on all those now, we would just have a maze of different proposals.
A colleague of mine said, how about a record before such and such a date? Do you have any?
Well,
Like the real early?
Your copyrights are potentially anything after 1906 is still covered by copyright. Or could be covered by copyright.
Right.
Your sound recordings aren't before 1972, but they may be covered under state common law.
Exactly.
So that's, unfortunately, some investigation has to be undertaken before you do anything.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. The woman in the back just left. She wanted me to answer one of her questions. She just left. I'll have to wait till she comes back.
I'd like to know if you could please direct me towards a section or perhaps a case you know of regarding Native American recordings.
Okay.
And maybe reformatting, because most of the tribes, at least where I do come from in New Mexico, are a sovereign nation, and they do not always recognize some of the copyrights laws, and it does create some problems.
Okay.
So that would be helpful.
At the top of my head, I can't, but I can investigate that for you.
Could I email you?
Yes. I'll give you my card, please.
Okay,
but
I
know something like that came up, and now I can't remember off the top of my head.
Especially since we do have the Repatriation Act now.
Yes.
And we do try to work as much as we can with the tribes, but sometimes when the governor changes every year, it gets to be complicated.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is Jim Farrington from Wesleyan. Will it make any difference in terms of these acts for mounting sounds on web pages, whether it's a downloadable file or whether it's a streamed file that doesn't actually reside on your computer, is sort of passing through and then erases itself automatically?
I think that is addressed somewhat by the ephemeral recordings. If it's passing through and you download it, is that the question? No, sorry.
Well, the difference is, there's a file that you would take and download, and then it would reside on your computer.
Yes.
And that I see as one thing. A streamed audio thing resides on a computer somewhere else, and it never actually, it just appears through
appears
your speakers,
even
on your screen. It just goes through your speakers, and then, you don't actually ever own it. It never resides on your computer except in a very temporary cache that's always updated. So you never can actually have that file on your hard drive.
Okay, that's, again, I can't give you a definitive answer on that, because this is just in the proposed laws at this point. I believe, though, the ephemeral recordings would generally cover that, in the sense that it's coming through, it's temporary, you're not capturing it, so your liability for infringement should be minimal. And like you said, it's completely different when you start downloading things and then making copies of that. But if you temporarily see it and do not make a hard copy of it, or don't hold it for any substantial time period, your infringement should be minimal.
I wanted to identify yourself. Oh, I'm Annette Kaufman. I was wondering what happens with countries that reprint books like, say, China or Taiwan in great numbers and never pay any copyright, or what happens with the Russians and all the Eastern Bloc companies who have never paid any attention to copyright laws. Is something being done to sort of correct that in an international way?
Yes, it is. For instance, I can address China specifically. A few years ago, I'm sure everybody knows that there was great raids in China on copyrighted or infringed copyrighted works, and they were just, I think the Chinese government were running over these CDs and books that were being destroyed in Shanghai. This is more a political question than anything. The Chinese and the Russians and Taiwanese They want to sign on to international agreements, but then don't respect the laws. For instance, in patent law, the Chinese have only had a patent law for 12 years, and they've effectively enforced it for a few years. They're coming around, though, because they want to join the international community. They want to join the economic growth and enjoy the benefits of that. At this point, the Chinese say they're enforcing the copyrights, and all we really can do is stop the importation into the U.S. We really can't do much within the Chinese borders because we can't do anything about that, except maybe impose political sanctions or economic sanctions. But that's to the extent, that's what's going on right now. They're getting better, they're getting much better, but really the only way we can force them to obey the laws is probably through economic or political pressure.
What about the rest?
Well, the same thing there. It's just if they want to join our international community, they're going to have to listen or obey our laws. And at the present time, U.S. copyright law can't do anything overseas. If they sign Berne conventions and things of that nature, we have some recourse against them. But again, it's more of a country by country situation where you just what can you do? You can't do anything unless stop trading with them. That's about it.
I'm Sam Berlowski. I wanted to ask you a question, which maybe the response would require you to answer more informally than as a copyright attorney. But in the laws or proposed bills, the bills which you've listed today, is there anything in any of them that should make a record collector or someone interested in old recordings happy?
Well, I'll tell you, it hasn't overhauled the old rules. It basically makes the accommodation that now instead of, for instance, the law stated in facsimile form only, now it's expanded it to digital formats too. The laws are changing, but they're not, it doesn't give you a free license anymore.
Well, it just seems like the screws are tightening and nothing really but that. I mean, if there was a loophole discovered either through something vague in the old law or through a new technology, it's just being filled up. I don't see any member of Congress or in the Senate who's defending the rights of users. I'm speaking mostly for sound recordings now.
Sure.
And music.
I don't see any great advantage over and above what you have now. There's not, now I can just do this. Well, you can do it in digital format. That is an advantage. But there's no expansion of the user's rights, and that I can tell at this point. But you also have to be concerned with, you may be the user, but if you were the owner, you don't want the user to get any more rights than they have.
Yeah.
If you're the owner of a recording in the 1950s or 60s, and you still want to make some money off of that, you don't want the law to expand to allow people to start making digital copies of your property right in the 1950s.
In music school, it's not an unusual practice to allow a student who's given a recital to acquire several copies of that recital without any consideration of whether any of the works in the recital are copywritten. The student needs that if he's going to make application for graduate study, for example. Each college that he or she makes application to requires recordings. He may want recordings for his parents or other relatives. As far as I know, music schools in general don't trouble themselves about that. They just give the student as many copies as they want. To me, strictly speaking, it sounds as if the law doesn't allow that.
Well, once again, we have to evaluate fair use considerations there. If the student is using it for his or her own, I hate to say commercial gain, because anytime you get a job, it's commercial gain. But if the student is using it for its own purposes.
I agree. I think it's a fair use. I would say it's a fair use.
That's what I was getting to. The purpose and nature of the use, which is not for, it's not for commercial gain off of that recording. It's for the student's commercial gain to get a job. The nature of the copyrighted work.
But on the other hand, if someone wants to copy a record and give the copy to a few friends, that's not for commercial gain either.
Well, you're destroying the potential market, though, or you're affecting the potential market of that recording. So if you made, say, some movie, some recording star, and you made a copy of that CD and decided you're going to give it out to your friends, well, then you've just really taken away 10 sales from me, whereas...
Provided the article is available in stores and so forth. You give someone a copy of a recording that's never been reissued, and it's 50 years old, or less than 50 years old, say. You can't say in that case that the copyright holder is being deprived of any profit because he doesn't have the object on the market for sale.
Well, now you're getting to, he doesn't have it for sale, but do we know that for a fact, and do we know that he would not offer it for sale? See, a student recital is going to be a little bit different for him to try to obtain a job to have a copy of that for his own personal use versus you making a copy of an old recording that you may think is out of print but could be out there somewhere.
Hi, Mark Tollison from New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. Is the concept of the library premises being reconsidered or redefined in the digital era? For instance, the campus of 4 library buildings in one system?
At the present time, I don't believe so. I have to investigate that a little further. I think that the concept of the library system, even in the digital era, is going to remain as broadly defined as it is. I haven't come across anything that would state or lead me to believe that they're going to change that definition or that concept. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
We go for our questions.
At the end of this morning? Oh, yeah.